when you were born, researchers came around and kind of gave you a drop of vitamin A supplementation. You gulped it down. That was the end of it, right? And so, then months later, a tornado hit. You had all these negative health effects. What happened to those babies compared to the babies who did not have vitamin A at birth? And what we find there is that essentially almost all of these negative impacts that I mentioned were erased.
Vitamin A deficiency can put a child at greater risk of disease and early death. The advantages of vitamin A supplementation in boosting a child's immune system are widely accepted, with Bangladesh being one of the leading public health figures in its implementation. What is less widely known, however, is the protection that timely intake of vitamin A can provide to infants against sudden environmental disasters such as floods and tornadoes. In this episode, we turn to Professor Achyuta Advaryu, who teaches economics at UC San Diego and is a co-founder of the Good Business Lab, for a tale of vitamins and a tornado. Welcome to Banglanomics, a podcast series to propagate economics research for the masses and students of economics with a focus on Bangladesh.
Oh, thank you so much, Professor Achyuta, for joining us today for this conversation. Before we start talking about the paper in question today, really, I really wanted to ask you first, what motivated you to come into economics and an academic career in economics, really?
I have kind of always been interested in sort of social impact, and this kind of goes back to my roots when I was a kid. I came from India to the US when I was a toddler, and so I don't remember living in India, but for the first 4 or 5 summers of my life here in the US, my parents and I used to go to India, and I used to spend most of the summer in India. And as a little kid, 5, 6 years old, like, some of my first memories of India are all the kind of amazing things about the sights and smells and crazy sounds and wonderful food and family and all that, and kind people, as well as then some of the images of poverty and kind of struggle and challenges that I observed, kind of being in an urban environment in Ahmedabad, then just witnessing that firsthand as a kid, it really kind of drove home the message that, wow, there's a really wide world out there that is not my suburban life in the US, with all its sort of comforts and all that. So, just experiencing that firsthand was really impactful for me. And, in the back of my mind, even though I probably didn't have this well-formed thought, I was thinking, why do people live like this? How is this possible? Why don't some people have homes? There's kids just like me who are like playing on the street corner. What creates these kind of situations, and how do you help people like this? Those thoughts became more well formed over time and kind of drove my interest in economics, because that's the major policy lever that you use to think about questions around poverty alleviation and helping folks who are struggling in society, social protection, and all that.
That's a fantastic way to put this, because one of the things that we always suggest for students who are interested in development economics is to travel, go to these places, see the people, live their lives as much as you can. It really puts things into perspective. So the title of the paper is Protecting Infants from Natural Disasters: The Case of Vitamin A Supplementation and a Tornado in Bangladesh. What was the main motivator behind the study?
Yeah, so I mean, has a kind of a funny history, but I've been interested in this question of sort of protecting children, or especially young children, from kind of environmental impacts for a very long time. And there's this kind of stems from a really robust and long literature that looks at the impacts of early life conditions on outcomes both early in life as well as kind of for adults. And so, that literature generally finds that factors that influence the health and kind of ability of infants to thrive early on really kind of have a lasting impact that kind of follows people the rest of their lives, which is pretty remarkable. So think about, you know, if you happen to experience a few really hot summers during your childhood and you're growing up in a rural area, that means that your harvest is not going to be as good as it could be. Or you have some other kind of environmental shock, like a hurricane or natural disaster that affects your area where you live, or you know, you just happen to have a mother who's going through some mental health issues, or has kind of dietary deprivation in terms of not getting enough nutrition. Those things then get transferred onto infants as well. And so, what is remarkable, I think, like, you know, everyone would kind of would guess that not having enough to eat makes you stunted or physically not as tall or not as robust. But I think what is really remarkable is that those things actually end up translating into your economic outcomes also. And there's, you know, a host of different studies from around the world demonstrating really quite rigorously this kind of fact over and over again, that there's really long-term economic impacts of these kinds of environmental shocks early in life. How do we then think about, you know, what sort of policies might actually generate protection? Snæbjørn Gunnsteinsson, who's on this work, is an economist, and he was a couple cohorts below me at Yale when we were in graduate school. And I was talking to him, you know, over a beer about this agenda at some point and my interest in it. And he said, when I was a master's student in public health, that he had been involved in taking part in this kind of vitamin A supplementation trial at Johns Hopkins that was taking place in Bangladesh, and looking at the effects of vitamin A supplementation on mortality, because vitamin A deficiency is a big killer of infants in these deficient areas. And so can supplementation at around the time of birth actually make a difference? So that's what they were trying to evaluate. And he was kind of helping with the implementation of that trial. He was living in a rural area of Bangladesh during this time. Imagine this, like, very white Icelandic guy, like, in the middle of rural Bangladesh, but he had a great time. But one of the really interesting things that happened is that during this trial, there was a tornado that tore through the study areas and destroyed homes, destroyed public facilities and roads, and really wreaked havoc on people's lives. You know, luckily, the trial team was extremely good, and they were able to kind of, like, keep the implementation constant, even though people were feeling the effects of this tornado. But Snai and several others thought that it might be useful to then sort of, like, study where the tornado had hit, and for the purposes of documentation and maybe even for future research. So they actually did a survey to complement the rest of the trial, where they asked people who had been, you know, in these tornado affected areas about what had happened and how badly they were affected, et cetera. So he kind of briefed me over this at some point in New Haven, and we said, wow, this, you know, it was really interesting, because there's this kind of interesting overlap between these two kind of things, a natural disaster and then some kind of mitigation through the supplementation that was going on through the trial. So I said, you know, we should file this away as potentially really interesting to look at this question of protection against natural disasters. And we got back in touch at some point after we had both graduated, and we said, hey, we should kind of work on this. And lo and behold, ended up writing a paper.
Some of the students watching this might be first-year students or second-year who are not yet introduced to the idea of identification.
You know, this is something that took me a long time to understand, even, you know, into graduate schools. So identification is really about, how do we understand the causal effect of something on something else? What you want to do is, we want to be able to say, if Adnan takes the COVID vaccine, then he's going to be 60% less likely to contract COVID over a certain period of time. Okay. But how do we establish what that number is, right? Because if we just went around, you know, giving the vaccine to people who wanted it, and then tried to look at their ability to contract COVID, lots of things might be different about people who agree to take up a COVID vaccine, right? Compared to people who don't. So Adnan might say, yeah, I'll sign up for a COVID vaccine, but you also might have very different health behaviors than folks who say, no, thank you, I'm not going to take this vaccine right now, right? You might have certain preconditions that make it higher return for you to take a potential vaccine. You might be more educated and so believe generally that the vaccine is a good thing. Across the board, you might have a whole host of different beliefs and behaviors that make it, you know, you a very different person than someone who refuses to you know, take up the COVID vaccine, right? So, so we can't just compare the outcomes of people like you who take the vaccine up and people like somebody else who does not take the vaccine, right? So what you need to do is think of a way in which you can kind of distribute the vaccine to a group that is identical in all ways to another group who doesn't get a vaccine. And then you can kind of track their outcomes and sort of see what would have happened if you hadn't given the initial group the vaccine. So the word that we use for that is called the counterfactual. And the counterfactual says, in another alternate universe, we would withhold the vaccine from Adnan, or we give him a placebo because there may be some effects of just taking anything that we want to capture. Okay. Of course, we don't have sort of parallel universes to measure your behavior in different settings or your outcomes. So what we need to do is sort of try to replicate that. And the way you do that is in a randomized control trial is that you essentially have a group of people who've decided I want to be part of this trial and to potentially get a vaccine. And then I'm going to randomly allocate the vaccine to a treatment group. And I'm going to randomly allocate a placebo or some other intervention to a control group. Then I can test the impact of the vaccine by comparing the outcomes of those two groups. And since I randomly distributed it, there was no reason, you know, nobody was saying I will take this up or, you know, making a decision in terms of the take up. And so I'm able to track the outcomes and those things can identify the effect of the vaccine. So that's what we call it, identification. Now, how do we use it in this, you know, setting? There were two things that we wanted to identify. So the first was, what are the effects of being exposed to this natural disaster, the tornado, on the outcomes for infants? So the basic idea there was, I'm, you know, 6 months old, I'm chilling in my house, and suddenly the roof blows off and, you know, there's widespread damage. People are injured, crops are damaged, my livestock, my chickens and rabbits are killed, roads are destroyed, there's not that much to eat. How does that affect my, you know, growth? That's the first thing that we wanted to identify. The second thing, it relates to this protection feature. So the idea there is we want to know, because these tornadoes, natural disasters, et cetera, are happening all the time, can vitamin A supplementation actually mitigate some of those impacts? So if I happen to get vitamin A when I was born, now at the age of 3 months or 6 months, when I experience this tornado, do I have a different experience than someone who was not supplemented? So is there a protective effect? That sort of like 10,000 foot view is, we're going to think about measuring the effects of the tornado by basically looking at, you know, your exposure to the tornado, which we've got data on. And we know which sites were exposed to the tornado and which weren't. So in a kind of very basic sense, if we believe that the tornado's path is random, like nobody's choosing where the tornado goes, right? It just goes wherever it's going to go. And, there, you know, you effectively have some randomness in exposure. And then we're going to overlay on top of that, the tornado ran through the study areas that were part of this trial. And there we have, you know, explicitly randomized exposure to supplementation, because that was part of what the trial did, was assign some areas at random to be areas where all the infants would get supplemented, and assign some areas as placebo areas where all the infants there would be receiving placebos.
Thank you so much. How did you guys select the outcome variables and what do they really represent?
It's always a very long deliberative process coming up with the right outcome variables, right? And so the biggest, you know, piece of this is kind of measuring the health of the infant, right? So we want to see whether on some actual objective margins that these infants are better off or worse off, right? We used a mid upper arm circumference for infants and young children. It's actually highly correlated or predictive of mortality. So if you have a very thin mid upper arm circumference, that indicates, you know, that you have not received enough nutrition, that your probability of premature death is much higher. That was a really important one for us to measure. And we also had standard measures like length, head circumference, chest circumference, weight of the baby. So like essentially measuring how big these babies were and how likely they were to be nutritionally deprived.
Thank you. So what did you guys find?
You know, the findings really kind of shocked us. The part that was less shocking, I guess, was the fact that the tornado had really big negative impacts on infants. When, you know, babies in utero were exposed, so their moms were exposed to the tornado while pregnant. When they were born, their probability of birth weight, low birth weight went up by about 15% on the mean, and their birth length decreased by half a centimeter. So it's a quite a huge shock to the physical length and weight of the baby. Postnatal outcomes, so if you were exposed when you were very young, so, you know, 0 to 3 months or 3 to 6 months, you also had quite negative impacts. There were big impacts in the first 3 months of life on chest circumference and mid-upper arm circumference, and then also on the incidence of severe fevers. It wasn't surprising that basically when you were exposed to the tornado, they were, you know, meaningfully smaller and were less well-nourished and more likely to be suffering infections. The incredible part of the study was then looking at the differences across babies that were supplemented at birth with vitamin A. So this is like literally a one-time, when you were born, researchers came around and kind of gave you a drop of vitamin A supplementation. You gulped it down, that was the end of it, right? And so, you know, then months later, a tornado hit, you had all these negative health effects. What happened to those babies compared to the babies who did not have vitamin A at birth? And what we find there is that essentially almost all of these negative impacts that I mentioned were erased for the babies who were in the vitamin A group. So they experienced almost no impacts. All of the impacts that we were talking about came from the group who actually, you know, did not receive supplementation. So that group experienced really dire impacts of the tornado. Whereas if you supplemented with this one-time supplement, basically impacts were zero. So that was a kind of major takeaway, that basically the supplementation at birth, it's an incredibly simple intervention at the heart. You know, we know how to deliver it. It's very uncomplicated. It just involves a dropper into a baby's mouth one time. And that seemingly protected against huge implications for the babies and their futures.
It can be really cost effective in terms of implementation as well.
The question is, you know, this trial did an incredible job of finding infants right when they were born, because they had staff in every single village of the study area administering this stuff. And the time to administration, you know, average time is well short of a week. So within a few days, this, you know, staff member would come to your house and then give you the dropper. So what I think is still unknown is if we sort of did this in a scaled up way and we had, you know, vitamin A available at public clinics, say, for people who wanted to come and get it, right? Not everybody's going to come. And then a lot of people are not going to come right after the baby's born, right? That's like sort of infeasible, because if you live really far away from a clinic, mother's still recuperating, like, you know, the baby's not going to travel a long way when it's 3 days old. You need some other kind of strategy to reach people right when they're born, because we don't know what the effects would be if we waited 3 months or some longer period of time. You would need some other kind of study to investigate how long you can wait before these effects kind of go away. What that indicates in terms of policy to me is that you would need community health workers who know how to do this, who are really responsive and who are kind of living in the village, who can say, okay, such and such just had a baby, I'm going to get my vitamin A supplement and go to their house and visit them within the first few days and make sure the baby gets the supplement. And that's probably quite cost effective because community health workers are not highly paid, you know, medical staff. They're sort of lower level workers. They're incredibly important, but they are, you know, don't require a lot of medical background or training. And they're just doing this kind of simple interventions and they can have quite a big impact. So just extrapolating probably underscores the importance of having a community-based health worker model.
The other part of the findings that I thought was interesting was the gender differences. I was curious about why do you think that really came about and what is the reference to the fragile male model that's made?
The finding is that the largest impacts were for boys and also the largest protective effects were for boys. So we really see the biggest negative impacts of the tornado and the sort of largest mitigation showing up for boys. For girls, we also see some of the outcomes moving in the same direction, but a little bit less of a magnitude. Why that is, we don't have a clear answer to that question. This is kind of now outside the realm of what I would feel comfortable saying in the paper, but if I were to guess, it would be that there's a lot of evidence that boys are actually more susceptible to negative shocks in utero and, you know, in the first year of life. There's something called the fragile male hypothesis in public health and medicine, which is essentially related to the idea that actually just genetically, for some reason, when babies are created in utero, the kind of percentage of male fetuses are like actually slightly higher than the percentage of female fetuses. And then male fetuses tend to be slightly more susceptible to small shocks and things like that, which then cause them to be aborted. So you actually get closer to like 50-50 once babies are born, but in utero, actually, like a lot of the aborted fetuses tend to be male. So miscarriages that happen in general that tend to be skewed slightly male. Now these are like small deviations, but you know, across the population, it kind of generates this more evenness when you're born in terms of the number of women and men born. My sense is that fragile male hypothesis kind of carries over into these shocks later on as well, that if you have a male infant that's exposed to this kind of natural disaster, maybe the impacts are like more severe. We can't really dig into it as much as we'd like to, but it's something of interest for future work, perhaps, to see whether that's a physiological thing or whether there's some behavior that's intervening there.
It's a curious area to really explore further. The other finding that that you guys briefly mentioned in the introduction really is about the maternal supplementation trial that was also going on. And you guys mentioned that you guys do not find any protective or mitigating effect of the maternal supplementation. I was just wondering if you could quickly, briefly comment on that. And again, your thoughts on why you think that's not really coming through.
Yeah, no, so it just turned out that basically there was also a maternal supplementation part of this trial where moms were receiving supplements once they got pregnant. So once they knew that they were pregnant, the study team enrolled them and then gave them supplementation of various kinds or placebo. And so that trial was kind of overlaid on top of the infant supplementation trial, because basically the policy question was, do we have to supplement infants right after they're born, or can we supplement moms and then it gets to the infants in utero and then they're protected? But their basic finding was the maternal supplementation doesn't really generate the same benefits as infant supplementation. So we don't report those in the trial because we don't find much. And the main reason is the actual supplementation actually didn't change levels of vitamin A or beta carotene in the blood. There was no what we call an econ, the first stage. You know, you supplemented moms. Hypothesis was that that would then get to the babies. Turns out that not enough of the supplementation gets to the babies in utero. So when they're born, you actually don't even get differences in vitamin A. Then the ability of that to protect, it doesn't really make a lot of sense because they don't actually have different levels.
Concluding statements. And so this part is going to be about policymakers. If there is one major policy suggestion that you could provide to the policymakers in Bangladesh based on the study, what would that be?
The key takeaway was that vitamin A supplementation at birth can be very protective for infants in terms of mitigating the impacts of natural disasters. In natural disaster prone areas, the government should consider mass supplementation campaigns. You know, that's not so costly because vitamin A is very cheap. The costly part is the sort of like organization and manpower around that. Like, how do you actually get people into every single village, finding babies right when they're born? That is the sort of harder thing to orchestrate. Currently ongoing, most supplementation or vaccination drives take place in public health centers, which are not always very close to the population in rural areas.
Any advice, feedback, comment you would like to pop to the students who would be listening to this podcast, especially people who are thinking about pursuing a career in economics, perhaps in the research track in the future? What would you like to say to them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, top few that come to my mind are one, you know, thing you mentioned, which I completely agree with, is that if you're interested in development economics, then, you know, I highly recommend going to these places of the world, you know, because it's hard to think about this just reading some academic paper and sitting in your office or your classroom. You're a world away if you're in, you know, Sussex or San Diego or wherever the case may be. It's important to kind of like go into those communities and spend some time, you know, either being an RA or in some way kind of experiencing what it's like to walk a mile or a kilometer in their shoes and understanding some of the constraints that they might face. Just that qualitative understanding is really, really important. And I would say even more important than how much you can read and digest in terms of academic literature. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is that I would really try it out. It's sort of an experience good in the sense that, like, it's hard to know if you're going to love a career in research until you actually are in a research team and having regular contact with a professor or a PI and getting a firsthand knowledge of what that research process looks like. So whether it's working at a university for somebody or working at JPAL or BRAC or Good Business Lab or whatever the case may be, spending some time in that research team is really important to actually understanding whether this could be something that you really could do for the rest of your life. And I don't think it's the answer necessarily needs to be yes for everybody. I think a lot of people find like, oh, wait a second, I was interested in this, but only as a consumer. Like, I don't want to actually, you know, be involved in the nitty-gritty stuff around data cleaning and blah, blah, blah. And I think knowing that beforehand, I got really, really lucky because I went to grad school when I was 21, right out of college, and happened to love it, but I knew nothing about it going in. So I got lucky. And I had lots of friends who had the opposite experience where they thought they liked it. And then they got into grad school and then sort of halfway through, they're like, oh, actually, like, this is, I don't want to be spending my time doing this. Like, I'm actually, you know, much better suited doing something else. You know, my set of skills or my interests are different. So I think just knowing that to the extent you can before you get into it is really important. And then last, I'll say, I mean, the whole research endeavor is something that, you know, a lot of people who are graduate students ask me, like, do you try to identify a research question and then like figure out how to answer it? Or do you just like go into some data and then like figure out what the puzzle is and then kind of like back out a research question? It's obviously a mix of both, but to be honest, when you are starting out, the latter strategy is actually like probably more reasonable for a variety of reasons. Like, one, I don't think a lot of people, you know, don't have the experience as undergrads or grad students in like how to ask the bigger picture questions, or really don't really know what's missing from the literature yet. And then also, as a graduate student or an undergrad especially, you don't have resources to just materialize a large scale RCT. Once you know, I can't just like pick up the phone and call George Soros or whatever and get him to fund my, you know, next RCT. Take like large data sets and explore interesting variables there. You know, start mapping out things, start thinking about summary statistics and say, oh, this is weird. Why is the labor force participation rate so low in this state, but not in this state? I think a lot of great research questions come about because, you know, you just find a puzzle in the data and then you go about kind of investigating what could be going on. And usually there's a good economic explanation in there that you can suss out, and then it'll make a nice paper. So I encourage students to do that. Don't go for the sort of like big picture question, what's missing? That's important to do, but probably in the next stage of your career.
Thank you for the session today.
Thanks. And I appreciate this effort and hope that folks tune in and connect, because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, especially as undergraduates, you know, about sort of what economists do and what the studies we do can accomplish. So I think that this is a great way to fill that information gap. Thanks. Talk to you soon.